Welcome to WRHU's One-on-One Stories. For the next 30 minutes, our host, Dr. Gregory Barroza, will talk with influential and inspirational guests. One-on-One Stories explores all areas of life and lifestyles affected by health, fitness, nutrition, medicine, mental attitude, and general well-being. Our guests discussed unique aspects of their lives and work, including current, controversial, and offbeat subjects of interest to all of us. It's One-on-One Stories with Dr. Gregory Barroza.
Did you ever wonder what it would be like to be a third-generation immigrant fighting your way through the everyday politics of life in New York, doing your best to assimilate, to secure your future, and to proudly raise a healthy American family? Would you be as industrious as today's guest to work your way through an advanced education leading to a law school degree from Notre Dame? Could you imagine yourself pursuing a career in public service back in an era when working for the government was more of an honor and commitment than it was the most financially rewarding career? And how about beginning that pursuit with a very limited budget and obligation to raise a family and many days, weeks, months, and years ahead to develop and support a very diverse constituency? Today we have the distinct privilege to talk to one man who in real life has accomplished all of these achievements and more. He is a renowned national politician who votes his conscience, often having to buck his own party, in support of the citizens he represents and following his convictions. He has been responsible for the safety, health, and financial well-being of his constituents both in his New York district and on a national level. He takes his personal fitness and sports interests as seriously as he does his political concerns, and he's even authored a few books. Today we have the distinct honor to chat with Congressman Pete King. You're listening to Dr. Gregory Barroza's One-on-One Stories.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna cure my ear. I got a bad case of love.
Today, you will be listening to the first of a three-part series with Congressman Pete King.
Hi, this is Congressman Pete King, and you are listening to Dr. Greg Barroza's One-on-One Stories.
A little background on today's guest. 2020 will be the 14th and last term in the U.S. House of Representatives for today's guest. He's been there 28 years now, representing both the 3rd District and 2nd District of Nassau County since 1992. A Republican representative, Congressman King, credited with winning political races by large margins while his opposition often significantly outspent him. He was voted the most bipartisan member of the U.S. House of Representatives via the bipartisan index by the 114th U.S. Congress. He has a reputation of being an independent leader who always fights for his constituents, even if it means bucking his own party. As far as national credentials, he's been a leader in the homeland security, strong supporter of war against international terrorism, both on the home and abroad. He's a current member and twice former chair of the Homeland Security Committee. He's held a series of hearings on Islamic radicalism, although you originally were a strong supporter of religious freedoms for Islamic faith and houses of worship, funded secure cities programs to protect New York and Long Island from nuclear dirty bomb attacks, previously served on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. You've been a ranking member of the Subcommittee on Emergency Preparedness and served on the Financial Services Committee until January of 2020. Representative Congressman Pete King, we're so pleased to have you with us this morning.
Great to be with you, Doc. It really is.
You're a great guy. You're a tough representative for us. I told our recording engineer, Fritz, today that you have an amazing sense of humor, so it always comes through in the interviews.
Okay.
You're a well-informed independent Republican who Newsday declared to be a stand-up guy who isn't shy at tangling with the powerful, even within his own party. You're a strong supporter of law enforcement and protecting veterans' benefits. Tell me a little bit about your attitude in that regard and how you got that reputation.
Yeah, first of all, it's a good reputation to have. I don't know if I fully deserve it, but I'm happy to have it. No, I just feel that, you know, you're elected by the people, and you have to fight for them in the district. Now, they may not always agree with every particular position you take, but when it comes to fighting for them, for instance, on hurricane aid, on homeland security, on tax issues that directly affect the district. My obligation, it's almost like I'm a lawyer fighting for them. That's my job. And sometimes, especially in Washington, where the Republican Party is primarily based, you know, the members of Congress that are Republican in Washington, the strength comes from the South and the West and the Southwest, and they have little interest or regard for New York. So when it comes to appropriating money, for instance, after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, within 1 week, we gave $65 billion to Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, and I voted for that. I was proud to do so. But back then in 2012, when Sandy hit, and we had as much, if not more, devastation than the southern states, all they wanted to give us was $27 billion when we had well over $60 billion in damage. And that was a real hard fight. I had to go to the House floor. I had to make threats. I had to use all the power I could and to stand up to my own party to make sure that we got the money that we were entitled to. So that's one example of it. And again, if you're a congressman from the area, and I'd be home at least on the weekends from Washington, and I go to these neighborhoods like Lindenhurst and South Seaford and Babylon and others and see the devastation, Massapequa, to see the devastation. It was like a third world country. And it was just something I had to fight for. So, you know, that's how I got it. I also, going back 20 years now, I voted against Bill Clinton's impeachment, which I believed at the time, and I still believe, whatever Bill Clinton did, it didn't warrant impeachment to undo an election. And that caused quite a bit of friction within my own party.
I sort of promised another journalist that I know that I would ask this question, and it's of interest to me, too. When you have strong personal convictions and your constituents you believe might have a different opinion than yourself, how do you balance what your best representation for your district would be?
Yeah, basically, if it's something you feel on a very gut or emotional or moral level, you have to vote your conscience. But here's the difference. You can usually anticipate what issues might come up like that. It's important that your constituents know in advance where you stand, what your positions are. For instance, to give you an example, I mean, if you were a Southern senator in the 1950s or 1960s, your constituents probably wanted you to vote for segregation. But if you thought it was the wrong thing, and you thought that segregation was wrong, then to me you had the moral obligation to vote against it. But I think you also owed it to your constituents to know, so they would know when they went to the polls where you stood. My position is, these are my views, and look at the whole package. Look at everything together and decide whether or not you agree with me more than you disagree with me. But no, that's the the age-old issue. But if you just voted on every issue the way a majority of your constituents wanted you to, you wouldn't need a congressman. You just need an applause meter. What you really owe your constituents is your best judgment as to what you think is the right thing to do, and they can always vote you out at the next election, or if you announce beforehand, which I always try to do, let people know where I stand, they can vote against you in the first place. And so that's really what I've, the stands I've taken. You know, when John Kennedy wrote Profiles in Courage, it was basically you had people who were going against what their constituents wanted at the time. I think in the fullness of time, like for instance on Bill Clinton's impeachment, many people, certainly the Republican Party, disagreed with my position. Now, today, especially after they've gone through the Donald Trump impeachment, more and more are saying that I did the right thing back then with Bill Clinton. But no, that's a constant tension that you have to resolve and try to do as best I can.
Well, you've done a fine job. I hear a lot of comments on both sides of the aisle regarding your tutorship, but you've done a fine job. The next thing, I looked up some statistics, it might be a little bit off, but supposedly you've sponsored 399 bills or potential bills, and you co-sponsored another 4,576. Of these committee assignments and bills introduced, let's say something can come through even after you've left office. Do you have any one, two, or three passionate ones that you really think deserve to be passed that you'd be very anxious to hear happen even after you're out of office?
No, most of the ones that were absolutely critical, fortunately, have been passed. For instance, like on Homeland Security. Homeland Security, 9/11, it was only this last July that the final 9/11 Victims Compensation Bill was passed. We had passed them previously, but they didn't extend long enough. So now 9/11 Victims Health Care, 9/11 victims' compensation, all of those are paid fully through 2090. And that, to me, was like the last major struggle. Now, there's other issues like the Grumman, you know, the Navy Grumman plume that's coming down. It's coming from the old Grumman headquarters, old Grumman factory up there in Bethpage. Hopefully, that will be resolved. It's going to not be this year or next year. It could take another 5 or 10 years. But if we can get the final overview, the final comprehensive plan in place, then I will feel very, very good about that. But others, you know, many of those bills you sign on to, you know that they're not necessarily going to pass, but you're doing it as a way to draw attention to an issue. And ultimately, they do end up passing in some form, or policies do get changed. But I would say the main thing for the last 18, 19 years, I've been involved in a lot of issues, but the main ones focused around Homeland Security and 9/11 victims, because that had such a direct impact on Long Island and also in the country, but especially on Long Island. You know, there's so many friends and neighbors we had who either died that day or have come down with illnesses related to 9/11 since then, and also families that are still going through psychological trauma because of what happened on 9/11, because of the loss of relatives or friends that day.
One of the areas that you've spoken out strongly about, and it was crossing your party line, was about you think it's time for some sort of reform or change or improvement in our gun control laws. And primarily, I think you're leaning more towards the registration of these guns and not preventing people from carrying guns. This, I believe, is one of those issues where you've taken a stance that's important to you, that's sort of against your party lines. But I know some of the things that you've said, I don't want to quote them. I want to hear what you have to say about it.
I support the Second Amendment. But to me, the Second Amendment cannot be a suicide pact. The key issues that have been out there, I've been one of the few or handful of Republicans that voted for these measures. One is on background checks. To me, anyone who has a gun should be required to go through a background check to see whether or not they have a criminal record, whether or not they have a mental health issue. And that should be not just in stores where you go to buy the weapons, but also at gun shows where many weapons are sold. You go to a gun show and the background check is nowhere near as comprehensive as it should be. And I don't know why anyone believes that it's wrong to be questioned whether or not you have a criminal record and whether or not you have a issue of mental health. And so that's one where I really have broken with the Republican Party. And it has nothing to do with taking away anyone's guns. Well, I shouldn't say that. The only one who would lose their guns would be, again, criminals or people with mental illness. And I don't see why any valid gun owner would want people to have guns who have those conditions or those backgrounds. The other one is I introduced a bill at the request of Mayor Bloomberg and NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly at the time that if you were on the terrorist watch list, you should not be able to purchase a weapon. Now, we put a escape clause in there that if for some reason you are on the terrorist watch list for inappropriately, for instance, you could have a similar name to somebody else, you could have been mistakenly identified, there is a procedure to follow where you can get your name taken off the list. So again, why anyone would want a person on the terrorist watch list, if you can't fly in an airplane, you certainly shouldn't be allowed to get a gun. So part of it here is when people who disagree with me on that say, we're never going to vote for you, you want to take away our gun. So I said, no, I'm not taking away anyone's gun unless you're a criminal or a mental patient. But the issue of guns is so emotional. I would say if you take New York, certainly downstate New York, it's a different type feeling. People may have some disagreement with me, but it's not the opposition you would see in other parts of the country where ownership of a gun is basically a sacred right, and they feel no one has the right to interfere with that God-given right to own a weapon, even if it's very, again, involving crime or terrorism or mental illness. It's hard to understand or fully comprehend unless you talk to these people. And there's one member of Congress, he's a very reasonable guy. He's been actually very helpful to me on some issues involving New York. And yet he stood up once and he was talking about possibly supporting some gun issue. And then in explaining himself, he said, listen, I have more than 50 weapons in my home. And I go, my God, here's a very moderate, easygoing guy who is actually willing to consider some gun regulation, but he has 50 guns in his house. How many people have 50 guns in their house? And yet you get outside of, you know, Long Island and downstate New York, and it's not that uncommon. Certainly upstate New York, southern Jersey, and then most of the South and the West, people are raised with guns, you know, garden guns. So that's something I've had to contend with in Washington. And I just wish we had a more rational debate about it, and the opponents of the gun background checks, I just wish they would be more, less intense about it and realize that no person lawfully entitled to a weapon would have one.
Well, I read a former quote of yours that someone questioned your position, and you said, listen, most of the people that get shot and killed in New York are being, when we look at the weapons, they're coming from another state. So if we can't control that, we can't control anything. So that was an interesting concept.
Yeah, and that is a real issue. You have these gun shows down south primarily, Virginia and North Carolina are two of the states I know in the past that have been very guilty on this, quite frankly. And you would have guys coming up when the police were able to stop them or be tipped off about them, they would have cars, trunks full of weapons, and they bring them up and they sell them on the black market, sell them on the street. There's always going to be a market for that, especially among the bad guys. And so many innocent people have been shot in New York with illegal guns brought in from out of state.
Yeah, unbelievable.
You are listening to the first part of a three-part series with Congressman Pete King on One-on-One Stories with your host, Dr. Gregory Barroza.
Swinging back a little bit on a more personal background note, your father was a New York City cop. I understand that before his generation, your grandparents were immigrants, mostly Irish Americans, who you support very strongly. You're a true New Yorker. You were born in Manhattan, raised in Queens, and graduated St. Francis College in Brooklyn, then went to Notre Dame Law School. Did that background affect you so much so that you became who you are today, meaning a little bit law and order, a little bit more conservative, a little bit more human rights for people, not so left-leaning? Is that what had a direct impact on you?
Yeah, it has to. And when it's happening, you know, you don't realize it. I mean, it's almost like osmosis. I mean, I guess it would be easy for me to say I had a deprived childhood, which I didn't, but I hear some of these guys on television running for office, and they talk about how tough their childhood was. And that was, their childhood was no worse than probably 90% of the kids growing up in New York City at that time. I grew up in Sunnyside, Queens, which was in basically Irish and Jewish enclave. It was almost entirely blue collar. I think I was only maybe one person I knew of in the neighborhood whose father had gone to college. There were some rough guys there. Some guys went to jail. But it was nowhere near as bad as that sounds. I could make that sound terrible. The fact is, I never felt threatened. My friends didn't feel threatened. Some guys got in trouble. Others didn't. It was in school. We had more than 70 kids in the classroom.
You were assimilating like many Americans have, and you had a supportive family, which some Americans don't have. And
right.
Were you the first one in your family to get a higher education, meaning going to law school?
Yeah, first one to go to college, actually, I think. I think I had a cousin of my father, like a second or third cousin. He went to college. But no, there was nobody else in the family that did. My father and mother were both very interested in education. They knew the need for it, but you know, they were products of the Depression, and they couldn't, you know, they didn't have the luxury of going to college, you know, the opportunity to go, but they really encouraged my brother and me and my sister later on to go. Again, I went to St. Francis College. I got some aid from scholarships, and then I worked. I had a full-time job my last 2 years in college. I worked at St. Francis College. It was in downtown Brooklyn. Really good school, and it really punched above its weight. I was in downtown Brooklyn, and then I had a job working at the Railway Express on the west side of Manhattan, loading and unloading freight cars and trucks. And so I would basically go to school from, you know, roughly 9 to 2, 9 to 3, then go and work 4 to 12. Sometimes I'd duck out early, leave at 10. And I would do that 2 or 3 weekdays and then work on weekends. So I probably paid for, between scholarships and my own money, paid for about 75% of my college education and expenses. But I had never even been out of New York. I think I'd been out of New York City only a handful of times. You know, never went to restaurants, had vacations, all that stuff, which, again, I'm not complaining. I didn't know anyone that did. That was just the world we lived in. When I was in my senior year, I did want to go to law school only because I couldn't think of anything else I could really do. I applied to, you know, local schools, all good schools, and I was fortunate to be accepted. But this is how times have changed. When you're going through the applications for law schools, Notre Dame was the only one that didn't require a $10 or $20 application fee, believe it or not. That's what I went for in those days. So I figured I would apply with no thought of going. Just if you're an Irish Catholic kid growing up in Queens in the 1950s, you know, Notre Dame had this 1950s and 60s. This was like the ultimate. This was, whether it was football, whether it was the fact that it was a Catholic school, all that. That was everyone's goal, just to be a Notre Dame fan. And so anyway, I applied, never thinking about it. And then if I ever did get accepted, I could walk around with this in my wallet, and if I'm in a bar one night, I could show people that I had actually been accepted to Notre Dame. But I did get accepted. And my father sat down, and we realized that the money I had saved from the Railway Express and the money that my father said he could put it up, and the rest would be on, I could get some aid. And then the whole course of law school education, room, board, travel, and everything else for 3 years came to $10,000. I think tuition was $1,000, board was $1,200, and then you had travel and books and all that. Today, it's like, I don't know, I guess $70,000, $80,000 a year, almost $250,000 over a you know, three-year period. So in any event, it was a combination of loans, money from my family, and the money I'd saved. It was like a third, a third, a third. And so I went. It was a great experience. Again, one of the first times I was out of New York. Suddenly I'm on a 1,000-acre campus. You have TV stations in there covering the football games. You see guys walking down around the campus or on the cover of Sports Illustrated, Time magazine. And again, going to in school with guys from all over the country. It was a great, great experience. And I ended up meeting my wife out there.
Wow. Future wife. This show's about you, not me, but I can tell you my generation, and I'm only a few years younger than you, we all had similar experiences. And I tell my own kids, and now I work at Hofstra University, so I meet a lot of other young people, that their greatest deficit in life is they didn't have to work very hard for anything. And I think that it builds character, and it gives you a core to understand that life isn't easy and its challenges and on and on. So I applaud your efforts, and I wish more people had that opportunity and not feel like they're being taken advantage of for having to work.
Yeah, I think part of it is, whether it's social media or media, people are more and more look for instant gratification, think they're entitled to this. I mean, at no stage, let's say when I was in high school, even in college, was I thinking I'm going to be able to go to Notre Dame Law School? Was I able to think that I was going to ever get elected to office? But you just go along, and if you work, things, you know, those things can open up. And if I hadn't done that, I assume something else would have opened up. I mean, that's the, without getting into all of the other connotations, I mean, obviously, if you're African-American, if you're Hispanic from certain countries, there's going to be a prejudice against you. But again, there's also prejudice against Jews and Irish and Italians, probably not as severe, but if you can find a way to work through it. And again, I realize that certain groups, because of undue prejudice, they should get some extra help. But again, there's no excuse for people complaining about the country or expecting to be making $1 million. I mean, even now, you have people, you know, they graduate from school and they take a year off just to get themselves back. I mean, I took the bar exam on, I guess it was Thursday and Friday, and I was at work on Monday. I mean, now that's unheard of. Everyone takes at least a few weeks off after the bar exam, or others take a whole year off after they graduate from undergraduate school, or they talk about, you know, their European vacations, or, you know, if we went to Rockaway, it was a big deal.
Yeah, well, only because you brought this up, I have a whole format of questions, and you already answered one. I was going to ask you, as a teenager, did you ever envision one day spending 28 years of your professional life as a congressman in D.C. politics? And you already said, no way. I mean, basically, that was a unique experience. But you brought up other things about minorities, and later on, I'm going to ask you a few questions about boxing. And believe it or not, that's how it all came around. It came around with all these underprivileged groups having an ability to work their way out through sports. And in that case, it was boxing. What do you think, though, about D.C. environment, where it seems like the most popular candidate is the one that gives the most away for free?
Yeah, you're right. You have more and more candidates promising more and more. Part of that, I think, is because many people today, especially those under the age of 30, they didn't have to go through the really almost death-defying issues that previous generations did. I mean, how many people of our generations, I'm older than you, but it was well into their 30s or 40s before they really hit any kind of success. You have to work, and people had two jobs, and they were borrowing money. And again, with no guarantee that it was going to succeed, but more often than not, it did if you worked hard enough. And at the least you would do was better than your parents had done. And if you were lucky, you did even much better than that. But very few people I knew growing up felt that life owed us a living.
This concludes the first part of our three-part interview series with Congressman Pete King. We discussed sports, politics, and life. Please remember to listen in to the next two broadcasts. We encourage our listeners to email me via info@oneononestories.com with any comments, feedback, future show suggestions, and/or recommended guests and topics. That's info, I-N-F-O, one-on-one, O-N-E-O-N-O-N-E, stories, stories.com.
Congressman Peter King, I feel it's important that I tell you that all New Yorkers and U.S. citizens owe you a debt of gratitude and thank you for your 28 years of service defending us and supporting our best interests. I want to thank you as today's special guest, sharing your personal story and insight into the world of local and national politics, and for sharing with us your passions about sports and physical fitness. This concludes our interview today, and thanks again. I greatly appreciate the time you spent with me and with my audience. I know you have so many more important things that you should be getting back to, and I wish you only the best.
Well, Doc, it's always important to talk to friends like you, and thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It's been a great opportunity for me. Thanks a lot, and hope to see you soon.